Hello and welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selina Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pevitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
We are so excited for you to listen to today's episode because we were joined by very special guest, Marianne Power, as she talked to us about her new book, Help Me. We had so much fun recording this podcast, hearing all about Marianne's big experiment of basically road testing one self-help book a month for a year. And we find out whether it did, in fact, change her life for the better.
Oh, it's so good. It's such a good book. And we had such a good conversation about it. It's such a good conversation starter and so many different kind of angles. It can get you thinking about do self-help books work? Mm-hmm. Don't they work? Where do you have to treat them with caution? Mm-hmm. And also, I think what's so interesting about her is the journey that she has gone on is such an inner journey rather than, you know, a big outer journey with big, like, this happened and I moved to this country and I married this guy or I did, you know, it's actually all happening within her life on the outside, not changing much, but on the inside changing so much. And I think, I think it's the new Bridget Jones of our generation, actually.
Yeah.
I can totally see it being a film, a really good film about, you know, a woman whose life on paper looks pretty good. And she, you know, you would think, oh, she must be pretty happy. And actually she's not, but she doesn't understand why. And her ways of trying to figure it all out and the journey she goes on, which, as she openly says, did lead to a breakdown at one point and then up through the other side. So, yeah, I think it's such a brilliant book to read, even if you're not into self-help books.
Yeah.
Actually, particularly if you're not into self-help books.
And the book is out on the 6th of September in all good bookshops, so be sure to check it out and enjoy this week's episode. Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
So nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So to kick things off, could you tell us the backstory behind the book? Why did you decide to write it?
I was in my mid-30s and just really unhappy, actually. I was renting an exorbitantly expensive basement flat in Camden that I hated. And, you know, on paper things were quite good. I had a really, like, great job as a freelance journalist. And technically things were good, but I was just so unhappy. And I had been for years and had kind of been ignoring it with drinking and working and just sort of pushing it down. And then I remember, it just got to a stage where I had one particularly brutal hangover, where it was one of those hangovers where I was like, something has to change. This honestly can't carry on the way it is. But I didn't know what had to change. Like, I didn't really understand what was going on. All I knew was that at this point I was unhappy. All my friends were moving on and getting married and having babies and buying houses, and I was just drinking too much and watching a lot of the Kardashians, and I was in debt. I just was a bit of a mess, but I was hiding that from the world quite well. And then when I wasn't watching the Kardashians or drinking, I was reading self-help, and friends would always take the piss out of me for the amount of self-help I read, because I was a really bad advert for it. Like, I'd read books like How to Stop Worrying and Start Living 4 times. So then, like, one of my really good friends, and she was helping me on a house move, She picked up How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, which was on top of the fridge, and she was laughing. I was like, it's really good. It's like a classic. And she said, you don't worry anymore. And I was like, oh, well, you know, But I always thought self-help would actually help if I did what the books told me to do, because I never did. I would just read it and fantasize how about amazing my life would be if I got up to meditate and drink green juice every morning. And I had this vision. I really thought I could become a perfect person if I just tried hard enough and just tackled every one of my flaws. And so that's what I set myself, that mission, for a year. And because I was a journalist, I was sort of used to doing these crazy things for work, so I knew I'd write about it. So I just thought it was a really clever idea that I would, you know, write really great stuff about it and become a perfect person in the process. I honestly thought that would happen.
So is that what you, so when you started it, you were like, oh, I know, I can bring these two things together. I can force myself to finally read and do these books because I'm going to be writing about it, and therefore the outcome will be that I actually will become that perfect version of myself.
Yes,
that was the motivation. Oh my god,
because
amazing.
I would force myself to do things for work that I wouldn't
for
myself, and because I was blogging about it, I knew there was an audience after a while. So if I said I was going to do stand-up comedy, I had to do stand-up comedy. Now, I would never on my own, I wouldn't make myself go through that, but because I declared it and I was kind of doing it half in a work head but not really, I made myself do these really uncomfortable things and did that for 15 months.
And did you become the perfect... I'm interested. My question is, did you become the perfect version of yourself? And actually, what was the perfect... Let's start with, what was the perfect Marianne you imagined you'd be? So you'd get up, you'd meditate, loads of green juices.
It was like the Sunday supplement version of a person. You know, like I used to always read those profiles of these amazing women that looked like Elle Macpherson, and they had their own businesses and they were hugely successful, and they had their house in Notting Hill, and they, you know, had a hot husband. And I had this image of perfect. So I would be really successful. Mm. I would be really productive. I'd be really healthy. I'd be skinny. I'd have great clothes. I wouldn't worry about anything anymore. Yeah. I'd have enough money. I've got like gaps in my teeth. I'd have enough money to get braces to sort my teeth out. I just really, you know, just this glossy magazine person, which is kind of ridiculous because I worked for these magazines and papers. So I bought into it so much. It took a long time to realise that no one's life is perfect, which is such an obvious thing to say. Yeah. But I actually think I thought other people's lives were way more sorted than mine.
But that's what's being sold to us all the time.
Exactly.
That's why I'm interested about... I know we've got a list of questions and I'm just going to just throw them out and just ask some questions I want to... Well, because we're being sold this idea of perfectionism, I think self-help... even if they don't mean to be, I think it's often picked up so much by people who do want to be perfect.
Yeah.
And what I loved about the journey you go through on so many levels, I love it. I love it because I don't think we've got a lot of journeys of people going through transformation, but on the outside, there's quite big changes. You've got Wild and you've got, you know, Eat, Pray, Love, and she goes off and she goes here and there, and she, you know, has a spiritual moment with an elephant, and she eats a pasta, and it's all like, you know, and there's a lot of stuff going on. She's left her husband, she's gone through, and then she finds love at the end. It's all like pow, pow, you know, big headliners.
Yeah.
Whereas what was so wonderfully refreshing about your book is that it's almost an entirely... inner journey, and at the end of it, nothing major has changed, and it's like, but the and I have to be honest, I had to jump.
Sorry, that was a spoiler alert. Nothing changes.
Am I allowed to say that?
No, I'm joking.
Well, maybe big things. Anyway, but I think because it's such a common journey. I really recognize myself in this, of seeking out self help many, many years ago. Because wanting to be this perfect version of myself.
Yeah.
And then at the start of that journey thinking, oh, here I have found the answer.
Yeah.
And actually, I think I'm now much closer to that perfect version, and then becoming really self-righteous.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what happened, because my ego had inflated, strangely, started losing friends, distancing myself from friends and family. It all imploded eventually, and I had essentially a massive breakdown.
Yeah.
And that was the point where I was actually able to go... with my kind of ego fallen by this, completely disappeared, but had been so badly burnt that I had to start again, and this time as a far more vulnerable version of myself. So that seeking that perfection and getting into self-development, the wrong kind, led to the breakdown that I needed to actually start living life from the right place, and forgetting about the perfection, because I'd chased that and it'd worked so bad, and trying to control life.
Yeah,
I was just like, I'm going to hit 30, married with kids.
Yeah.
And none of that happened. And then it was just like, shit, okay.
But again, that's all stuff that's sold to us from such a young age, isn't it, of what life is. And so in my 20s, I thought, like, you know, if I was just successful, I'd feel okay.
Yeah.
And I was really successful as a journalist on paper, but I always felt like a total imposter. And then I thought, right, if you could just find the right man, then I'd feel okay. But I was always shit with men. And then even when I did get boyfriends, it was like, oh, I'm still me. It didn't fix.
Yeah.
So, I kept moving the goalposts. And then I had a year where I went to the gym obsessively and got really fit and healthy. And I thought that I'd feel happy if I had a six pack. Mm. And then I did. And it was like, oh, I'm just me again. Like, I never worked, whatever. And then I did it with self-help. I did this.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all versions of the same thing. This very human feeling of not feeling like you're good enough. And then setting yourself a project to fix that. But I think that's just part of... being a human is being vulnerable and flawed and beautiful and great, and all of it at the same time. We're not like this project that you can just cross off all the boxes and then
and make perfect.
Yeah.
And actually, I'd almost say that the people we look at that have the amazing house and the hot husband and the great body and the successful career, they could feasibly be some of the most unhappy people.
Yeah.
Because they've done all this. They've hit all the tick boxes. If they haven't done the work to actually just love and accept themselves, then they're not going to be enjoying any of that. And now they've got all the things that were supposed to make them happy. And now they're even unhappy.
It's very empty.
Where else is there to go? And I think, again, that's what I love about your book, is that I think it's going to resonate with so many people. On paper, your life looked great.
It really was. You know? And there was a bit of guilt around that too, because, you know, what on earth did I have to complain about? I had such a good life on paper, so privileged. I had, you know, basically healthy body and a roof over my head, an amazing job where I got paid to try out mascaras. I mean, really... But then I think, and I still had that kind of, you know, this kind of Catholic guilt of like, would you just be grateful, count your blessings and get on with it? And I think a bit of that is good, but also the stuff that we've been told that makes us happy actually doesn't make us happy. So it's funny, you can have the most amazing job and actually really love it, but it doesn't necessarily fill the hole that can be inside you sometimes.
Do you think that that is, if you look at the women and men who find themselves in a similar situation to you, life looks good on paper, I've achieved a number of things I have, and you know, I've wanted to in terms of career success and or whatever their success looks
or whatever
like
exactly exactly
and I'm still not happy. Where do you think that unhappiness stems from? Is it
I don't know if it's just some I had this like life-changing conversation with a taxi driver in the book.
Amazing.
Where this man is just so wise, and I kind of saw into my soul, and at this point I was really breaking down as well, having spent, you know, almost a year at this point doing all these crazy things to try and feel good, and just like you, going through this phase where I thought I had it nailed and I was very superior and fell out with a friend because I decided she was negative and I didn't want negative people in my life. Anyway, then I also fell to my knees, and this taxi driver, and I was like, does everyone have this in their life, this period where you just don't know what the hell you're doing and you crumble? And he said he thought that they did. So I think sometimes we can stay busy enough that you don't think about it. By nature, I'm a real thinker. So I think I kind of brought on my crises maybe earlier than some people do. And he reckons that it can be a death or an illness or something can really shake your belief about what your life is. And I think maybe just being human, at some point we have to just sort of grapple with ourselves and like, what is life about? Or just face up to your weaknesses, or not even weaknesses is the wrong word, but just face up to all of us, like all of the stuff that's in us, the feelings, the good ones, the bad ones, the fears.
And be like, able to sit with all of it.
Yeah, which is still like horrible. It's always horrible, but then it's beautiful. And so I don't know, with the unhappy, because some people actually, maybe they go through life and they don't. You know, that they really are kind of quite equanimous and quite happy with their lot. I don't know. But I just think being a human is a really up and down road. And
particularly if you're curious.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, if you're curious about life and you're questioning, eventually at some point that's going to start eating your own head. Which will inevitably lead to a breakdown. So I think it's a beautiful part of being curious, is that, you know, you end up over analyzing at some point, trying to think, oh, maybe I can control things so much that I can make a perfect version of me, and I actually can get rid of the stuff I don't like rather than have to do that uncomfortable bit of accepting it and being with it.
Yeah.
And maybe I can sidestep this altogether and not have to be that person at all. And, you know, no one's ever done that.
Yeah.
Dalai Lama hasn't done that.
No.
He's not trying to. That's the whole point. But I think media feeds us, which is so interesting, work in media. I think it feeds that idea. Of course, advertising feeds the idea, but you can be your perfect self if you use this face cream.
Exactly.
Or wear these clothes or lose this much weight with this product, or, you know.
And even the wellness world is a version of that too. Like we were talking about earlier, pay 30 quid for this green supplement and you will be bursting with energy. You know, all of it's good in moderation. Like it's really nice to like what you're wearing, and it's really good to try and look after your health. But when it becomes like this obsession of this was good, this is going to fix everything, it doesn't work. And there's industries around all of this. So this is the thing with the self-help. So the figure at the moment is that the self-help industry is worth $11 billion in the States.
Wow.
And that industry is based on the fact that one book or one course is never going to be enough. You always want the next one, the next one, the next one, the next one. Mm-hmm. And that, it's a business.
Did you start the book with any preconceptions of that industry, of the self-help industry, and did they turn out to be wrong or right?
No, I started just loving these books, but also being quite embarrassed that I loved them. So I loved them because self-help acknowledged like feelings and insecurities I had that weren't really being talked about in the pub. You know, it seemed to explain, this is, you know, so How to Stop Worrying and Start Living was the first book that kind of explained that feeling of just being worried all the time about everything. And he talks about trying to live in day-tight containers, which means that you literally just do everything it is possible for you to do that day and then stop, you know, instead of this constant worrying about everything 10 years from now. And so I found that I started off from a place of just really finding them very helpful. And just, yeah, being probably, as it went on and I was doing a lot of the books, I definitely drank the Kool-Aid. So then if friends... I found them helpful, but I was also a bit embarrassed of it. And when friends laughed at me, I would laugh along with them. That was fine. Then the more I got into my projects, when friends laughed at me, I didn't like it anymore. Like, I didn't want this to be a laughing matter. I thought it was very serious. And I was the only one...
I'm going
to
be perfect.
And I was the only one doing the work and they were all in denial. And, you know, this... And now, having come full circuit through, I still think there's so much good in it all. Like, we've always needed help on how to live a life. Like, it's why philosophy existed, and it's why a big part of religion. And it used to be that we had village elders or our grandparents. And now the way we're living our lives, we're quite isolated and we don't seem to have access to wisdom. Certainly, you know, I'm not religious, but so I think more and more of us are reading these books for that. And they really do serve a good purpose. But the danger of them is that they create a very high expectation of what life should be like. So in a way, they're doing another version of what the media does. That, you know, I went on a Tony Robbins weekend and he's like, Tony Robbins is this like 6'7" American self-help god who's like an Olympic athlete at life. You know, he's up
it's true.
From the minute he wakes up to... You know, I don't know if he sleeps or whether
relax. Maybe relax more. So this like have a cocktail. I don't know.
It's not very. This is the thing.
Get a cocktail.
Yeah, alcohol doesn't do it for him.
Oh, of course it doesn't. It's just like be spontaneous today. No, I have a plan. Like I have a plan.
Schedule spontaneity 6 weeks from now.
You know, I love your intensity, but maybe. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it all gets quite intense. It
very
does.
Intense.
It's quite.
Well, he's drunk his own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean he doesn't make a huge difference to people, because I'm sure he does. But,
All of it in moderation.
Yeah.
That's such a boring line. But yes, the self-help industry, I think there's so much good in it. And the reason it keeps growing and growing and growing is because we need it and we're quite lost in a lot of ways. Like this.
That's interesting that you think that, because I was wondering if. Because when I was reading it, I turned to Vicky and I was just like, this has put me off us ever writing a book.
Yeah, oh God, sorry.
I think self-development is the best thing that has happened for human beings. I think it's so important, so powerful. I think it's great that it's come into the mainstream now. But what I'm curious about, and particularly from reading your book, and I never thought about this before, was that maybe books are not the best container for self-development. And this comes out in your book, is about the importance. I think you quoted Brené Brown talking about, she doesn't really get self-help because she's just like, the most important thing is that you have someone listen to you and be heard. And for me, my experience has been, you know, self-development in groups with a therapist is the most powerful. I've never had the kind of profound life-changing experiences with a book that I have had with a therapist over time, or with you know, group therapy, self-development stuff, or it has to be the right self-development stuff, because I've also had terrible experiences with big group self-development stuff. So, you know, you have to also choose the right guides. And she says, I think it's important that sometimes you are challenged, and also when you're reading the self-help books, you're reading it with the same worrying mind that got you to read them in the first place. So actually, you're just reading what you want to read, which is probably, I'm not good enough, I need to change, I can be perfect. And even when you say, you know, I found it really helpful. Well, actually, was it that helpful? You know, when you hear your friend going, you've read the book on Stop Worrying 3 times.
Yeah.
She's literally crying with laughter because you are the friend that worries more than anyone else. And it's like, so it's just, I think self-development is amazing, but I'm just wondering if book form is actually the best.
Yeah, but for me, I would not have been. So I've done the group therapy and the therapist now, but I would not have been able to do that until very recently. It would have been so out of my comfort zone.
Right.
So I think self-help books were kind of
primed you,
a safe, easy way, you know, because I'm like, going home and reading these books, again, slightly embarrassed, but it was beginning to get me into that. It was, that was the first time I was even ever even allowed myself to think about feelings or what it was. So yeah. I wouldn't have been able to go into a therapy or a group therapy situation in my 20s or even my early 30s. I would have found it so uncomfortable, so terrifying, so threatening to share myself to someone else, because I was always so petrified of being judged. And I thought it was embarrassing to have these feelings. And so for me, self-help was a kind of a probably a necessary, safe way to get into some of the deeper things that can happen with therapy. But yeah, working with other people is definitely the most healing, but also the most terrifying stuff. You know, when you're standing up either in a group therapy situation and just spilling out all your, all the stuff you normally keep so hidden. I mean, that's puke making, but it's also beautiful. It's brilliant. But it took me a long time to get there.
That makes a lot of sense. And also in the self-help books, you always get that being understood. It's like, oh my God.
That's exactly it.
How have they seen into my mind? I do feel like that. I do feel shame about that. Oh my God, thanks so much. Thank God someone's put into words on a page.
Exactly.
It's not just me. And I think Brené Brown actually has a book called It's Not Just Me for that very reason.
Yeah, I was thinking of exactly the same thing. And I find with every Brené book, what I love about her style of writing, it's not selling you this quick fix.
No,
how to
not at
change
all.
Your life.
No.
It's just giving you a bit of a roadmap, or just like The Gifts of Imperfection, for example, one of her books. It's just telling you, here's a guide, and this is what like life is all about.
Yeah,
really encouraging you to see your whole self in all your wonderful wholeness, you know, all your flaws and limitations, all the great things about you, to really celebrate that and not just try and hide all that away and just constantly on this like quest for self-improvement to be this perfect, to be this perfect you. And I think that is such a gift, like to be understood when you read a self-help book. I guess like Brené Brown would be classed as self-help, but it's not.
It's,
I find it's a bit different.
It is,
to the traditional self-help. But how that could be then a stepping stone to doing much deeper work.
Because Brené Brown is just beautiful and amazing in her work. So she says that she doesn't believe in the term self-help because she doesn't think we're meant to do it on our own.
Yes.
So it's such a good way of putting it. So she is described as self-help, and I don't think she's very comfortable with it. And I think that's, there's a lot of truth in that. And but her, she just describes what it's like to be human so well.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, right, so everyone feels like this. And so she talks about that we're living in this time of not enough, that none of us feel like we're good enough or clever enough or pretty enough or successful enough. And she says that when we have this feeling, which was the feeling I always had, that we do a few things, and the first thing we do is we try to be perfect. So we either like work harder, or we go to the gym, or we try and find the perfect relation. We try to be perfect because that's our way of controlling the world and running away from this horrible shamey feeling of not being good enough. And when that doesn't work, and it never ever ever works ever, because she says there's no such thing as perfection in the human experience, when it doesn't work, we do a few things, and one of them is numbing. So we watch television, we drink, we eat, we shop, we do anything to distract ourselves from that feeling in our tummy that we're not good enough and that no one will love us ultimately. And we also cut off from people. So in my book, it totally started from that feeling of not being good enough. And then, you know, I didn't realise it at the time, but this, you know, mission to be perfect with these self-help books. And then, of course, it didn't work because it just was never going to work. While I was reading all this self-help, I was also, and doing all these, like, I was so brave, I did loads of amazing things, but I was also still watching the Kardashians, still drinking insane amounts of wine, because the more I was trying to perfect myself, the more I felt like I was failing.
Of course.
Because the standard was getting higher and higher. If I wasn't like a cross between Buddha and Beyonce, I wasn't doing it right. And so then that feeling of failure got bigger, and then I was drinking more and watching more television, you know. So this numbing thing, again, she describes so well. It's like, oh my God, that's the story of my life. Like before and after self-help, that's just, that's the human thing. And then the cutting off, feeling kind of ashamed of not, you know, I never wanted, this is something that's absolutely something I have to kind of work on for the next few years. But my nature is to go on my own.
Yes.
And so reading books is probably part of that kind of personality. If I can just go away and read and fix it, then I'll come back and then I'll be worthy of being in a room with other people. It's not by my nature to share, and I still need to work on that. But she says that's the only thing that will ever help us, is sharing the stuff that we don't want to share with another human being. And the kind of, not, it has to be the right person who will listen to you and get it.
Without judgment.
Yeah, because not everyone is able to. Not I think, through bad intentions, because I sometimes think that people have probably tried to confide in me and I just haven't really understood where they were coming from. So if you find somebody who you can trust, and just the process of them listening to you and not criticising you, just them, you know, she says very often, then they'll kind of go, me too. You know, I feel like that too. And then that's the most healing thing, because then you realise, God, we're all the same. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, then they sort of, that's just like a, there's a peace in that, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. We were talking about that in our last episode on heartbreak, actually. The best thing you can do from a friend or any loved one when they're going through heartbreak is just, rather than go trying to fix it or let's just go out and get drunk, it's just like, just listen, just let them pour all of it out, even if it's ridiculous stuff, like, and I know I'm gonna, you know, it's never gonna happen for me and I'm wretched and I'm horrible and it's because all these things. It's just like, don't even rush in to go no, just go, okay, you know, I get it, I know you feel like that. I mean, I totally don't believe that, but I know you feel like that. And I, you know, and just hearing it, and that is the most, really the most healing thing that we can we can do for one another, and that we can receive as well. And I think that it's just about us opening up more like that. And it's so interesting, you know, with Brené Brown, her whole thing is stop trying to be perfect. It's humanly impossible. We need to so all the time, whereas I think some self-help books, perhaps they forget that themselves, and they think, I can help these people be, you know, oh, I hate the term, being the best version of myself. That's basically like saying being the perfect version of myself. It's just not far, it's too close to that, that I'm just like, I never try and be the best version of myself. I just try and be me in that moment. Sometimes I've really got my A game going on, and sometimes I don't. I mean, like, so I'm just going to be me, whoever turns up today.
It's all putting ourselves under pressure, isn't it? Which is why I liked another book called Fuck It, which is, he's an English author, John Parkin, who was a stressed out advertising executive and had a real burnout and what's it all about. And he got into all these sort of alternative Eastern philosophies and he kind of did everything. And then ultimately came to the conclusion that he just had to stop trying so hard with any of it, all of it. And he has this theory that fuck it, when we say fuck it to worrying about our weight, worrying about work, worrying about the future, just say fuck it, that it's the Western expression of the Eastern philosophy of accepting and letting go. And
I
you
love
just
it.
Lighten the fuck up. And then actually, bizarrely, things seem to go better that way, don't they? It's like when you quit your job, you relax and then suddenly you quite like it. And why, when there's, you know, the guys that you don't fancy tend to fancy you because you're just being relaxed and normal. And when you go through life just desperately trying to be on your A game all the time, that causes a lot of tension. And actually things don't seem to flow your way that much, that well, I think. Sometimes the less you care, in a weird way, it's kind of liberating, and then you can be open to how things are actually going, and you have a great conversation which unexpectedly leads to something just because you were relaxed enough in that moment to have that conversation. Instead of being going, no, but I have to be there and I have to be doing this. And so I loved him. So the so the funny thing with all the self-help is that I'm so aware of the dangers of it all and the high expectations and also the self-obsession it can lead to. But this, the wisdom in the book, I live with it all the time. So Fuck It, John is in my head all the time. And it's not that I can't live it a lot of the time, but I do know I have that feeling of the lovely moments where I have said fuck it and it's fine. And Brené Brown stays in my head, so that's, you know, really helpful framework, you know. None of us feel good enough. This is what we do when we're feeling like that. This is the cure. And it doesn't mean I still do it all the, you know, do everything she says, but I know that as a kind of a truth.
Yeah, as a little guidance in your head when you need it. And Eckhart Tolle was a
I love him. I love him. So I tried reading The Power of Now a few times and I could never get on with it because the sentences are so weird. It's like just very gobbledygooky, strange language. And I read it in this project when I was 12 months into doing self-help books. I'd had a couple of like little mini breakdowns along the way. Had been, you know, pushed myself so hard to do all these uncomfortable things. So feel the fear and do it anyway. I was jumping out of planes and doing stand-up comedy and naked modelling. And then I did rejection therapy where I had to get rejected every day. And then Tony Robbins where I ran across hot coals. I was putting myself through a lot.
So punishing.
It was punishing. It was actually punishing. and then all the while beating myself up that I didn't yet feel perfect. And so then it all came unstuck. And then in that unstuck period, I read The Power of Now, and this time it was like a heaven's opening moment where every word felt like the truth. And Eckhart Tolle talks about, it was the first time I'd read it, like describing this voice in our heads that he says that if you see people walking down the street talking to themselves, you think they're mad.
Oh, yeah.
But we all do that. We've all got this voice in our head that's narrating everything we're doing and criticizing and comparing. And this voice is, he says, either in the past or the future. So you're beating yourself up for something you did wrong, or you're having an imaginary fight with someone who you think did something wrong to you, and you're outraged and indignant and you're better than them and all this stuff. Or you're in the future imagining when things will be better in the future, or worrying about things that will go wrong. And he says that we go through all of life missing the only thing that's ever real, which is right now. So right now, he says, whenever you're in a moment and your head is spinning, he says, just ask, right now, do I have a problem? And like right now, we don't. We're here having this lovely conversation. Right now, there is no problem. Life is really good. And he says 99% of the time, if you ask yourself that question, the answer is always no. And even when the worst things do happen, say you're sick or someone's in hospital or you've lost your job, when those really bad things happen, we usually surprise ourselves at how we're able to deal with it. It's just something that needs to be dealt with. And yet we miss out on so much of life dress rehearsing these awful things that could happen, and it's such a waste. And anyway, he describes these negative thoughts as being like records. That it's not the truth. We just put these records on every day, the I'm fat record or I'm lazy record or men don't like me record or whatever records, you know, and we all have like a familiar collection that they just go on all the time. And he talks about just to stop those records to breathe. He said it's hard to be in your head and your body at the same time. So breathe, feel your feet, feel your legs, you know, just do this body scan of... So Eckhart Tolle, I loved, and I still, like, he's my version of The Power of Now is like the scribbles of a mad woman, because in the margins there's just all these exclamation marks and yes.
I've got that in your book. I've got corners down, I've got yes, I've got, you know, different things, like, self-help gurus have said, I'm like, yes, oh my God, and you know what you've said, and then,
and just like, yeah, I looks like the scribbles of mad woman.
Yeah, but that's...
It's a good sign, thank you.
But I still turn to that book. I find him hugely comforting.
Yeah.
And when my brain is going off on one, like I was just telling you guys, I had to do a big talk in Holland this weekend that I was just petrified about. And even though I had in my head, you know, be in the now, it's fine. Just like for the last 3 weeks, I've just been a nervous wreck about it and not sleeping. But when I wasn't sleeping, I was either listening to American political podcasts because I don't understand what they're talking about and I find it quite distracting, or I listen to Eckhart Tolle's audiobook and his little German voice soothes me.
Just reminding you, you're okay.
Yeah.
I think also a reminder of in that, those situations, of course you're terrified.
That's,
most people would be.
A friend said that too, just of, allowing yourself to feel terrified, because there's still that tendency in me, that punishing, like, right, just fix this. You know, don't waste these 3 weeks being scared. Just pull yourself together. And it's like, well, no, this is like, it's public speaking is known to be more terrifying than death to most people. Like, there's always these polls that come up that people would literally rather be in the coffin than give the eulogy. It's a Jerry Seinfeld joke. So, like, it's normal to be scared and to just let yourself off the hook with these things. The tendency to be hard on myself is still there, but I suppose I'm a bit more aware of it now.
So it's interesting, a big part of the book, or a big personality of the book, is your mother. She's absolutely amazing. She's hilarious. And really reminded me of my mum.
Yeah.
And I was interested how, because I think there is something in that generation of our parents and our generation which has self-help, which they didn't have, and has self-development tools, and therapy is a thing that a lot of people have done now, which in their day it was like only a few were kind of, you know, right in, like, well, in a desperate crisis moment in your life. And even then you probably just sort of like, you know, stand yourself up.
Yeah, pull yourself together.
Pull yourself together. Yeah. So... And it was great because a lot of what your mum said, I was just like, God, that's exactly the stuff that I used to be told, particularly by my mother, when I was on my sort of trying to make myself perfect. Because actually, in a way, they were right. I think, you know, perhaps they can see in you, like, you're literally going down a rabbit hole. It's not taking you anywhere good. Yes. But they can't sort of identify exactly what it is. But at the same time, I think there is a tendency of, like, just deal with all this emotion and like sharing and stuff. This is very uncomfortable for me. Just pull yourself together, crack on, let's do some washing up, let's tidy the house, let's do some things, let's go and be there for other people, because that was also the other thing. You know, I used to get told, you know, what would really work for you is to become a parent, because then just stop thinking about yourself, which drives me nuts, because I don't think parents should stop thinking about themselves. I don't think having a child is an excuse to stop, you know, growing and expanding and all the rest of it. But it's what bringing your mum into that, do you think it brought a useful kind of contrast?
She was in my head the whole time, because I was really aware of how this was looking to her. So my mum grew up on a farm in Ireland, one of seven children. There was, so she says she wasn't brought up to contemplate her toenails. You know, there was no discussion of feelings. You just, you know, you had your list of jobs every day, and she was raising her younger brothers and sisters from the youngest age, then went into teacher training college, was a teacher, married my dad, had us. There's never been a time in my mum's life where she wasn't looking after people. So what I was doing was so the opposite to my mum's approach to life. And you know, mum's also really stoic, so it's not like she hasn't had her share of challenges. She really has. Mum puts lipstick on and tidies the house and gets on with it. Whereas I will cry and analyze. And so mum was in it because in my real lived experience of doing all the self-help, she was very much in my head as this kind of like a source of guilt in a way, and the voice of reason, but then also as a representation of a different generation. You know, she's not the Oprah generation, I was the Oprah generation. And throughout the year we were kind of at odds. You know, I would take everything she said as critical. So also mum, there's one point when during The Secret I was writing pretend checks to myself, and you know, The Secret says you can have anything you want in life if you just believe. And so I was road testing Mercedes and doing vision boards and, you know, imagining what it would be like if I had an LA mansion. And so then my mum phoned when I was in the middle of doing this vision board. It was like she could sense.
Oh my
whenever
God,
I was doing
so
something so ridiculous, so that would be when she would call. Like, literally,
and like, what are you doing?
What are you doing? Writing post-it notes to myself saying you are beautiful.
I think she could sense. She's like, Christ, Marianne has got up to something completely bonkers. I'm going to give her a call.
So I was telling her about the check and, you know, and about positive thinking, and she said, you mean you delude yourself? And I said, no, you just replace your bad thoughts with good thoughts, and who knows, you know, maybe all this stuff can happen. And then about the money, she said, oh, at least when you get too big for your boots, you can buy new ones. And then suggested that maybe I could use the money to get my roots done.
Ouch.
They were, but it's funny, for mum, it never felt ouch to me. It was, I think what I was doing was so extremely, you know, quite bonkers at times. So she brought me down, but it never felt harsh. It was just, she was just trying to, I think she was probably quite worried about me actually at points.
Oh, sure.
And didn't, you know, wanted to be supportive, didn't want to say to me, don't do this, but I think she just didn't understand what I was doing. And then at one point when I was making myself sick from all this, pushing myself, and she also said that line of, you wouldn't be able to do this if you had three children to look after, which is actually practically true. I wouldn't.
But it's not what you need to hear in that moment.
But then, by the end of the book, where she is, you know, says some really beautiful things, that's how she wishes that she had thought about life a bit more than she did, because it just wasn't what they were brought up with. You know, I think I went too far in examining every aspect of my life, and I thought that the more I looked at my shit and the more I addressed stuff, the better I would feel. But actually, there does come a point where too much self-examination goes to self-obsession, which goes to self-loathing.
Well, particularly
it actually
when
doesn't
you're...
make you better. There's just a balance with all of it. And I think mum could see that. Like, this actually isn't making you happier.
I do think it's interesting that, because I think generationally we have gone from being like, come on, just get on with it. Which I think a lot of us then have, particularly as women, that's why I should be able to do it on my own. I should be able to fix this.
True.
I should be able to
sort
this out. I shouldn't need other people. I'm a strong, independent woman. But also I think we've moved now into our generation of, for the first time, actually our emotions coming to the surface. And whether we want to or not, here they are. And we have to deal with them in a way that our parents couldn't, didn't have the tools, but also it wasn't in their generation. It wasn't in their kind of like... their landscape.
The zeitgeist dies, it was just not, yeah.
And so, but now it is. So it's kind of like, for those of us who are curious and want to get involved in life, that's where we go into. Yeah. That is the adventure, is the inner, you know, spiritual journey, which understandably to our parents' generation is just like navel-gazing, narcissistic, selfish, indulging, you know.
And it can be all those things, though.
It
so,
can
you know,
be.
That's the thing.
I definitely
with my,
went into that.
Yeah. So it's...
you know, it burnt me really badly.
Yes. Because when I got these kind of what I felt like criticisms, I was, you know, indignant and just... Oh,
self-righteous.
Yeah. But... I don't regret anything I did at all. I'm so proud of myself and I learned a lot. But I can also see it is narcissistic and navel-gazing to devote a year and a half of my life in the end analysing every single aspect of myself. And there comes, you know, you do feel very good when you've helped someone else. And I stopped thinking about other people. I was my full-time job. And actually it didn't make me happier. It was good work in some ways, but I also think that balance between thinking about yourself and thinking about other people, being in an inner world and an outer practical world. So Alan Watts, who's kind of a Buddhist really, he said first the ecstasy, then the laundry. So you need to have that balance between, you know, because I can get into all these big concepts, but also, you know, pay your bills, just do the practical things. And I swing too far to extremes, so... Yeah, I'm glad for my mum. I really am. I'm very glad for her constant, like, just little, what are you doing?
Oh, and she just, and I have to say, she did, just the love for her comes out of the book.
I do love her very much.
And just, and her and the love for you comes out of it. And it's just, that's why it's so funny hearing definitely phrases my mum has said in the same situation. Because they're scared of you.
Yes.
But I do think that narcissistic bit, getting lost in it, is a necessary part of the journey.
Maybe.
Because I used to feel a lot of shame for that time where I really thought I was suddenly superior spiritually and emotionally and in every way. Because I now had sort of found the truth and I was doing the work. I mean, just, you know, you're going in a bad place when you're saying things like that. But I pretty much was. And then for a while, a long time after, because it really, and I got into terrible relationships, which also kind of, and I've discussed it on podcasts before about this, but I felt a lot of shame for a while that I'd got so far up my own arse, but broken and lost and all the rest of it. But now I just think it was part of the journey. And like, just, there's no need to have shame about it. You know, didn't actually hurt anyone too badly
in
the process.
Almost,
Yeah, exactly. And I sometimes do think that particularly when we're seeking perfectionism, that's where it takes us, is to sort of narcissistic, selfish behaviour until it breaks us. And then we're like, OK, I'm going to try the other route.
Yeah.
Brené.
Brené, yeah.
You talk about the quest for happiness in the book.
Yeah.
Did you find that through the process of writing the book that you've changed your definition of happiness? What does it mean to you now?
Happiness is such a weird word, isn't it? Because again, it's happiness is something that's used to flog us stuff like Pringles. You know, do you remember Pringle adverts when once you pop, you can't stop and there'd be all these really happy looking people in a room together? That's what my picture of happiness was, that I felt like maybe that's what you should...
And Coca-Cola.
Yeah, that kind of big smiley... And Mum, when I started the project, you know, she said, what are you doing and why do you want to do it? And I said, I just want to be happy. And she said, no one can be happy all the time, Marianne. Yeah. It's not real. And I thought that was miserable when she said that. But actually, I think it's true. I think life has ups and downs. And I would be trying to be a robot if I was pretending I was happy all the time. But what I have found, thank God, is a level of like contentment and peace with myself, actually. I'm quite at peace with myself now in a way that I definitely wasn't at the start of this. I feel like I've looked under every rock of myself, you know, and so it's funny. I think it's hard for me to probably quantify how I've changed, but I think I probably am in the world in quite a different way. I used to go into every room and kind of compare myself to everybody on loads of different levels. You know, what they were wearing, how successful
inferior,
they were,
superior,
all that. And I don't tend to do that so much anymore. Like, I just feel quite at ease in the world, which is amazing. So I think that's a form of happiness. But happiness is a funny thing. It's life is up and down, and just peace with yourself. So Mum also said something really wise, which is when I was working really hard in newspapers and magazines and I was really stressed out, but I felt like a failure, that I wasn't coping with it very well. Even on the outside, I was coping with it. And Mum was like, you know, you have to leave this job, you're so unhappy. And I said, but I just want to be a success. And Mum said, this isn't being a success. You know, being a success is being able to wake up and look at yourself in the mirror every morning and wake up and not feel dread for the day.
Oh my God, I love her.
So that's true, isn't it? It's not a job title, and it's not where you live, and it's not... It's just that having a waking up and having peace with yourself, which touch wood, I kind of have. Not all the time, but basically, I think I'm a pretty decent person now. Whereas I didn't think that before.
No.
I thought there was something wrong with me.
I think it's the self-acceptance in you, without, there's no, I'm not going to do any spoilers, but at the end of the book, you just hear a very different Marianne.
Yeah.
And it made my heart burst. I was just like, oh, it was absolutely beautiful. And you can really sense it in the tone of the way you've kind
really?
Of written. Yeah, yeah, really. I had to jump to the end because I was really, I didn't know where it was going.
I know, it can go, it goes to some quite dark places and I think it's quite hard reading. I know.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. I just couldn't bear, I just thought, what if at the end... She just goes, self-help books don't work. That's it. Oh, God. So I went to I read, like, I don't know. I mean, no one should be doing this. You should just read the book.
Oh, no. Go on, do whatever you want to do.
But I was just like, oh, my God. And to hear the way you were writing, I was like, okay, it's fine. Everything's I'm going to go back now and make my way through as this book has been written. But I think that it's that self-acceptance and it's that voice in the head. And we, you know, talk about the shitty committee and it's all about learning to turn the volume down. You're always going to have it.
Exactly.
And you're always going to have moments of feel of self-loathing and doubt.
Yeah.
But hopefully they're fewer and further between and, you know, the volume is turned down. But I think self-acceptance is accepting that you're going to sometimes
have those.
Feel sad, feel superior to people.
Yeah.
The really gross stuff. Like, feel, you know, feel the shame. Feel, I don't know why, but I'm feeling really down today. And I didn't even know. It's like, okay, how about we just try and accept this?
Yeah.
Give myself an inner cuddle, make myself a nice meal.
Exactly.
Perhaps have a nap, you know, like not push yourself too hard today. Like,
exactly.
That for me is.
And I would
where
have always thought that would. I would have thought before that would be a total cop out.
Yeah.
Don't be fucking nice to yourself. Try harder. Whereas now, like, that would really. I was so brutal on myself. Like, when I was at college, too hungover to go to lectures, and I was trying to get myself to more lectures. And I used to have a post-it note on my bedside table, you know, next to the alarm clock, and it would say, "Get up, you lazy bitch."
Oh my God, I knew you.
That was what
that.
That was what I was. So that was a version of what I was doing to myself all the time. I definitely don't do that now. Terrible
really
way.
Have, like, a post-it morning sweetness.
No, actually, I wake up now most mornings and the first thought I have is, this isn't, I hope it's not conceited because I don't mean it to be.
You know we're going to love it.
Yeah, no.
This is us.
It's no. Well, like, I have, my first thought is, thank you world, I love you. But it's I love you to the world and I love you to me. And like that doesn't mean I go throughout the day with that state of blissed out at all. But my first thought in the morning is like, you're doing great.
Mm.
Like and it's amazing now the book is coming out in a couple of weeks and there's so much good stuff happening around it. And me being me, I'm feeling completely overwhelmed. And Mum yesterday said... It's like, I'm overwhelmed and I'm really scared of all, you know, because it's got very big and I'm scared of all of it. And she said, Marion, you couldn't be the person that wrote that book and also be able to handle all of this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's like,
and
we have both sides of
that?
Us, don't we? So just to accept, like, we have all of it comes together and...
The whole package.
The whole package. And actually the good stuff wouldn't exist without the things that we think of as they're not good, so good. But it's not even that this whole kind of good and bad isn't a helpful distinction either. You know, these are good feelings, these are bad feelings.
No, exactly.
These are good traits, these
are
bad...
feelings.
It's just feelings.
And that's something Alan Watts says as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A good feeling or bad feeling doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah, exactly.
It is what it is.
Exactly.
Yours is such a journey of self-acceptance and self-love.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that it hasn't got big life changes set on the top of it, because then you could fall into, oh, well, of course she ended up happy because she's living in LA in a mansion with a really hot husband. It's just like, well, you know, it's actually just like, it really was the inner journey and nothing else to distract us from that. And I think that is so powerful and so valuable and took such courage to write that book. Of course you're feeling overwhelmed.
I am.
I'd be in pieces.
It's very strange.
Very vulnerable.
It's out now with lots of people and the feedback so far has been really good, but it's just, these are all new experiences. I've never written a book before and it's so personal. And I knew that it was personal, but it's a very exposing, strange time and a beautiful time and a scary time. And
you're really being seen.
Oh, yeah. Mm. And And I'm scared of what will come from that, because inevitably there will be criticism, because of course there is. And I always knew that, but now that's coming closer. And so, yeah, I'm doing lots of walks around the block. I'm like taking myself like a dog around the block, like a few times a day, just to, you know, every time I look at a tree, think, oh, you know, sod it. It, like, the world is still there, the trees and the sky. And this is like a little exciting drama or moment, and it will pass. And just to try and enjoy the ride the wave of it, the kind of the feelings of scariness and joy and all of it,
and accepting it all, and yeah, it's a rainbow of and emotions.
And it's going to happen how it happens. Everything happens how it happens. And then, like, you know, with your breakdown, quite often the bad bits, it's not like we'd like them when they're happening, but they can be like the most amazing lessons in all of that. So
I always say it's the worst and best thing that ever happened to me. It was worse because it was horrible to go through, but it was the best thing because that's where my life took a path that I'm still on today, which is just to live a created life from the heart.
Yeah.
The end.
Yeah.
And exactly. And then eventually got into Project Love Vibes with Vicky, and it's like, and love myself, and thank you. And that is my destination. And it's not because I now love myself 100% all the time at all.
No.
Still got the shitty committee going on.
Yeah.
But we now have tools that, you know, help to turn it down and also just help to accept it when it's going on. Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's what fuck it, you know, is all about.
Yeah.
I think as well. It's just like total surrender and acceptance to what is right now.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Figure the rest out tomorrow, or just not at all, and just see where it takes me.
Yeah.
Relax a bit, or have a cocktail.
Relax. I went to see Liz Gilbert talked in London a few weeks ago, and that was her talk was about her one big wish for humans was not, you know, world peace, or that we sort out the situation in the Middle East, just that we relax.
Yeah.
But that we're all putting ourselves under such pressure to be all these things all the time, and we can't just relax. It's, yeah.
Because you think a lot better when you're in a relaxed mindset.
Because
when you're striving and trying, you're making decisions and choices that are all about that being, that perfection,
it's kind of from a fear
and that
mode,
where you're trying
it?
To get to, and that forcing and controlling. And actually, I remember Marianne Woodman, she said that perfectionism is the rejection of life.
Ah, wow, that's brilliant.
So it always does that.
That's
really
brilliant.
That sold me a long time ago. I was like, oh... yeah. Okay. So, you know, I've definitely got perfectionism tendencies.
Yeah.
When it happens, I can feel that.
Yeah.
That like cold.
Yeah.
This is not,
everything gets
this
brittle.
Is not this is a bleh.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but I think it's because I'm trying to control things again.
Yeah. 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 Fear.
You know, but I will always be someone who tries to control things. And that's also fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's in my nature. And the more you're aware of it, the less it takes control of you.
Yeah.
And then it's like, yeah, you've got to just embrace all of yourself, the ugly and the delicious and the, you know.
Yeah.
And not even call it ugly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's just...
Oh, wow. I'm so excited for this book to come out, people to read it. I think it's going to... Such great conversations can come out of it. And I think it's also really good, you know, for people who've never got into self-help or been cynical about it, that actually they might go into it going, this is going to prove me right that self-help books don't work or whatever it is. And actually that might be, oh, actually there is, you know, there is something.
So
they do play a role.
My editor in the UK is he's a 30-something man. He's quite bemused, I think, by the fact that he loved this book so much. And he's, you know, he doesn't read self-help. And
there you go.
He's not a 35-year-old woman having a life crisis, you know. So he's really, it's just being human. So it's...
I bet he's watched Brené Brown. I bet he's secretly got Eckhart Tolle on this, his audio books.
Well, I think you learn quite a lot from reading my book. So there's, you know, you're almost getting the takeaways from the 12 books.
I feel like everyone should read your book first if they're thinking about self-help.
And then pick the ones that you like.
And then just to approach self-help with caution or care. To see it in the right way, to not look at it like, this is going to help me, it's going to change my life, it's going to fix me,
and
this is the way I need, the one way I need to live my life.
Exactly.
Actually, to approach it in a softer, more gentler way.
Yeah, totally.
And to take what you need and not, like, just subscribe to something as, like, gospel, this is the way I need to live my life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Because I think the main message, you know, at the start, so when I was driving myself crazy throughout, probably about 10 months into the project, and my best friend just said, I just want you to get to the end of all this and realize that, you know, you're fine the way you are. You don't need to jump out of planes and run across burning coals.
Yeah.
people love you just the way you are. And when she said that, I was in such a mental state that I didn't believe her. All I could see was all my failings. And I started this project really thinking I was broken and that I needed fixing. And then by the end, just realised I'm not broken and I don't need fixing. And none of us do. But that doesn't mean you don't go out and try new things and, you know, yeah, of course try new things and try and improve yourself and learn about life. But there's nothing wrong with you right now.
Yeah.
Really. And that sounds trite, but there just isn't. You know, you're a beautiful human being alive on this planet. And to do it all from a position of everything's good already. So yeah, let's try this.
Yeah.
Let's read this.
Yeah.
Not this desperation that there's something wrong with you, because there just isn't.
Amazing.
Just feel like just a big sigh.
I feel so relaxed now.
Yeah. Oh, God. It's so liberating.
The pressures I'd put on this morning, gone.
Yeah. But we all do it. Yeah.
But that
would be my biggest hope for the book. And it was the beautiful thing when I was blogging, when I was doing all the self-improvement, the best part of the blogging was the conversations that it opened up with people.
Yeah.
So after I did stand-up comedy, which is part of my my month of doing Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, I got a taxi home, even though I couldn't afford the taxi at this point. The finances is a shocking bit of my book for some people. Got a taxi home and told the bloke I'd just done stand-up comedy. And he's like, you didn't. And I said, I swear I just did stand-up comedy. And I told him about Feel the Fear and why I was facing my fears. And he started telling me that since his wife had left him, he was finding it hard to leave the house, and he was particularly scared of going to social situations because he thought people were laughing at him. You know, on paper we would have been leading quite different lives, but underneath it all, we're all exactly the same. So we're all feared of being judged, and we've had our hearts hurt. And so that's what I would love for the book, is to just open up conversations about this stuff and realize we're all the same.
So what's next?
I guess ride this wave of this book. So it's coming out in more than 25 different countries.
Oh my god.
It's incredible.
It's insane, and there's new ones. It's insane. So it's insane. So quite like I am in a perpetual state of overwhelm, of like, it's amazing, I'm terrified. It's amazing, I'm terrified.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
I know.
Here is success, and it's terrifying.
But it's...
Which is often happens.
But it is, because it's a whole new world. So the book, it comes out in the UK in September, but it comes out in different countries over the next 6 to 8 months. So I guess there'll be a fair bit of travelling and talking about all of that. And yeah, so that's getting the book out into the world will be my next few months. And then issues from myself want to work on, and is stuff around love and money. So they were two big topics that are kind of addressed in the book, but I realise are bigger issues for me. So I'll start getting into all those sorts of, because I'd love to. Yeah, I have a funny relationship with money. Even now that it's coming in, I still have a lot of fear around money. So I'd love to kind of get more happy with that.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
And coming in to talk to us.
Thank you.
And the book's out on the 6th of September.
People
can buy it now.
It's available pre-order on Waterstones and Amazon.
Well done.
Thank you
for writing that book. It's going to make a big difference to a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's funny, guys. Sorry, I've probably got quite serious. It's a funny book, isn't it?
It's really funny. Yeah. It's hilarious.
I always forget that it's funny, but
I'll just add to this. I was reading the chapter on money, first one, Kate Northrup. And my husband was lying in bed asleep next to me, and I was laughing at the bit where you got your bank statements out and you were writing hearts around the statements and like beautiful Barclays. This myself.
Have you?
Yeah. I've done this myself. We both read a similar book. And I was laughing so much, but trying to be quiet because my husband was next to me and he thought I was crying. He was like, oh my god, are you okay? I was like, this bit in the book's so funny.
Out loud. Yeah, it is. It's a real laugh out loud book. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ridiculous things we do in the name of self-improvement. Art classes drawing hearts on my Barclays statements.
Beautiful Barclays.
Happy HSBC. Another one.
Like tip-exing the minus minus
oh, that was in The Secret. Yeah.
And just writing a different figure. Just, it's okay.
That's not insanity at all, is it? That's just positive thinking.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoy this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.